If you're anything like me, you spent your childhood assuming that one day you'd meet your Prince Charming. You'd get married, you'd have a nice house in the suburbs, a dog, a career, and a couple of kids. It never crossed your mind that Prince Charming wouldn't come along, or that tragically you'd lose him before his time, or that your marriage wouldn't work out, or even that your biological clock would have other ideas. Or maybe you never really wanted that sort of happily ever after. Maybe you never wanted a man, but you did know you always wanted children. We're living in an age where, for the first time, women can embrace motherhood on their own terms. They no longer have to put their lives on hold waiting for the right man, or settling for someone who they know isn't right for them, just so they can become a mother. More women than ever before are embarking on the journey to become what's known as a solo mother by choice. And while for a lot of us it doesn't feel like a choice, but more a necessity, the bottom line is there are now options for you to be able to fulfill your dreams of motherhood if the traditional route isn't playing out as expected. The No Need for Prince Charming podcast will share stories of Australian women who have successfully become solo mothers by choice. They each have a unique story as to why they decided to pursue motherhood in this way, and the journey they had to go through to make this dream a reality. The hope is that by sharing these stories, you'll have the knowledge and the confidence to embark on this amazing journey yourself, if you determine it's the right one for you. In the words of Walt Disney, all of our dreams can come true if we have the courage to pursue them. All you need is faith, trust, and a little bit of pixie dust. So welcome to the podcast today, Kate. I would love to start by understanding who you were before you decided to become a solo mum by choice.
So I think the first word that springs to mind is a workaholic. But also an auntie. So I guess my experience for the last 15 years is that my sister has twins and they lived with us until they were about three. And then for most of the time since then, they've lived next door. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so I've been an extra parent to my niece and nephew in lots of ways. I've done the school pickups when they've been sick and the homeschooling during COVID and all of those things. So I guess I've been kind of a pseudo parent in some ways to them, but also had that great kind of auntie relationship where I get to do the cool stuff and be the cool aunt and be the one that always says yes to everything and buys the ridiculous gifts and takes them on ridiculous experiences. I guess
back when it gets hard as well. So that's kind of
absolutely. Yeah. Although I guess, slightly less handing back when they're next door. And, I guess the way that our relationship has worked as well is that, sometimes I've had to kind of be the one to say, no, you can't do that naughty thing you're doing. It's been a bit of a different relationship, and it's just been, I guess, the delight of my kind of 30s was being around to as my sister was raising those kids. And yeah, now we're doing it with my little one.
Wow. And so what made you decide to become a mum on your own?
So this has really always been my plan A. I think I was never particularly interested in having a child with a partner. And I'm not sure, I can't pinpoint a time when I made that call, but really from, I would say, my kind of mid to late 20s, it's always been in my head that I guess I've always seen myself with a child, but not necessarily seen myself in a relationship with a child. Mm-hmm. And as I got older, I realized that there are lots of things about my life and the way that I live my life. And I live in a bit of a commune. Like I said, I live next door to my sister and I live with my mum. So we're all kind of in it together. And I can see, or I could see, bringing a child into that setup, but not necessarily at this point in my life, bringing a partner in. And it just wasn't something that I was looking for me either at this stage in my life or at this end, kind of any time in the last kind of 15 years. And so I've known for probably 15 years. And I think I was almost going to say I was ready for the last 15 years to do it, but clearly I wasn't because I didn't do it. I've really known that this is my path for that long. And it was a process of probably me making excuses to myself about why now wasn't the right time, why I need to lose weight, I need to get into a better financial position, I need to finish my PhD. And I did make one really deliberate choice about, I want to get to a certain stage in my career before I do this, so I'm not coming back and trying to climb the ladder.
Yeah.
I've known for a long time that this is how I would do it. And I think it was probably, oh, it was probably almost 15 years ago, the first time I kind of engaged online in this space, I joined the SMC Australia forum. And then when I was actually starting my fertility treatment, I went back and I saw how long ago I'd been there. And it was like 12 years ago that I'd been there saying, I'm thinking and wanting to do this. So yes, I've kind of always known, I think, that this was my path. And I guess I just never wanted to have a day where I had to not have my child with me. I see a lot of dysfunctional relationships and a lot of relationships break down, and the impact of shared custody arrangements on kids. And it's, I know it's not always the case that those things are negative, but sometimes they really are. And it's just not how I wanted to raise a child. And I guess I know from being around and helping my sister with raising her kids, I wanted to do the same, really. Was I've seen how good that's been for them to be kind of parented in this, we call it the commune. And I think I wanted to be able to do the same as well.
And so what did you reach that career milestone and then you were like, right, let's do this? Or did something else happen that was the trigger?
So I guess I probably could have done it career-wise a long time before I did. I had a big career shift in 2021. So I was an academic for over a decade. So working as a university lecturer and did my PhD, and then worked in a research-only position and kind of a more teaching focused position. And I got, during COVID, I got diagnosed with ADHD. And around that time, probably for about a year before that diagnosis, I'd been doing a lot of work with a psychologist. And one of the things she said to me was, why do you take on so much at work? Like, what drives you to do this? Do you need to feel important, or what is it? And I'm like, actually, I am just terrified of being bored. And that was kind of her trigger to go, maybe we should talk about ADHD. But those conversations around what I did at work and how that all unpacked made me realize that probably being an academic wasn't the right fit for me, in terms of the job is a competition. You're trying to win grants, you're trying to get things published, you're trying to get great teaching scores. And I was a workaholic already, and the kind of incompatibility of the competition with the workaholism and the desire to kind of do different things in my life and not work 70 hours a week. And, you know, and I knew that there is no way I would have been able to go through IVF in my job, let alone raise a child.
I was going to say, it doesn't sound very compatible for having a child either, no.
No, I don't think it was. And it doesn't necessarily have to be as extreme as it was for me being an academic. I think I am my worst enemy in many ways in terms of making things more difficult than they need to be. And I was having a chat with a friend today and saying, you know, that the hardest thing for me about going back to work is going to be managing me and my expectations of myself. But yeah, I think I knew that I couldn't. And I was living here where I live on the Gold Coast, and I was working in another city 3 hours away. So I was driving up and staying there a couple of nights and coming home. And I didn't want to relocate because I wanted to be here with the kids and my family. And none of that was compatible with what I wanted to do. So I had a big career shift and, you know, doing kind of a lot of work with my psychologist, who also challenged me and said, you've been talking about this for as long as I've known you.
What's holding you back?
Yeah. Are you going to actually do it, or are you just all talk? She was very good at challenging me. So that conversation, and then my GP said to me, you've got a significant birthday next year. I was 39. You know, are you still planning on having a kid? Because you really need to get on with it if you are, basically.
You've told like everybody who's ever met you that this is what you're going to do. And you just
everyone knew. Like, it was no surprise. Like, I mean, I collect earrings, and I was selling off a whole bunch of my earrings at the start of my fertility journey, and my friends were buying them all, and they were transferring me money on PayPal with like four sperm as the what the money was for. So yeah, look, everyone has known that this was my path to being a mother. Like, it was just always going to be this way. So yeah, my GP kind of challenged me, and then, you know, I had a dietitian who was like, you just need to trust your body, that your body can do these things for you and get off and get on the path. So those, I guess, were the kind of catalysts for eventually making it happen, that kind of career shift. And
And then you started treatment. What did you have to go through?
So, I think the first time I saw my fertility specialist, and I'd seen him in the past a couple of years earlier when I was thinking, okay, I'm going to get cracking on this, and then didn't get cracking on this. I saw him in December 2021, and I always knew who I'd see. It was my sister's fertility specialist, an amazing man who takes on hard cases. And thankfully, I don't think I was a particularly hard case. I didn't have any known fertility issues. But so I saw him in December 2021 and got started in January 2022. I did my first cycle, had my first egg collection in February, and we retrieved 10 eggs for that one, had 9 mature. Only 2 made it to blastocyst. And then we made a discovery, which is that I have an incredibly tricky cervix. So we went to do a fresh transfer, and I said to my fertility specialist, just a warning, because I went to have a Hycosi done where they put the dye into fallopian tubes quite a while before when I had a false start. Maybe that's why I had a false start, because that experience was so traumatic. And it was like the guru guy trying to do it, and he just couldn't access my cervix to pass a catheter through. And so I said to my fertility doctor, and I had a great relationship with him. I mean, we've known him for like 15 years, and I said to him, just, I had this experience with a Hycosi. This might not go well. And he's like, ah, 17 years, I've never not got the embryo in. And lo and behold, could not get the embryo in. So I left there feeling like, oh my God, I'm a freak and abnormal, and this is so much harder than it needs to be. And yes, I didn't get to do my fresh transfer, and so they froze both of the embryos. One of them could be biopsied, and that ended up being abnormal. So I did PGT for all of my embryos for testing. And I made that decision because of my age. So I was almost 40 when I started. And I know that there's a lot of talk around about, embryos that self-correct, and are you losing viable chances at pregnancy? But for me, at my age, the conversation I had with my fertility specialist was, I don't want to risk losing time to miscarriage, essentially, losing time and the kind of emotional weight that comes with that. And I wanted to have the best possible chances.
Is that why you didn't look at doing an IUI or anything prior to IVF as well?
My age was the deciding factor in that as well. My fertility specialist was willing to say, I was, basically due to age and, a variety of other factors, that I was infertile, essentially. So I was able to access Medicare. So I went straight to IVF. The real motivator for me with that was I wanted to biopsy as many embryos as I could. And I think, actually, in hindsight, if I had my time over again and knew what I know now, I probably would never have transferred any untested embryos. But that's part of the story, I guess. But so I had one biopsy, which was abnormal, and one frozen untested. And so we transferred that in my second cycle in April. I missed my next cycle because the testing wasn't back before I had my period. So and I that time I tested early at home, so I knew I was out. It hadn't worked,
How did they
so I went
overcome
back.
your cervix issues for that one?
Oh, I had to have all of my transfers under anaesthetic. So they were all hospital admissions and time off work, which was, I'm fortunate that I had an incredibly supportive boss who was very happy for me to, knew what I was doing. The first transfer, no one knew what I was doing. But after that, I was like, oh, I'm going to have a lot of hospital admissions here. So I need to tell them what I'm doing. All under anaesthetic. I think the first one was a full general, and then we realized that they could just like kind of sedate me very heavily, but not be fully out. Little extra complication and expense, but
Least they found a way to get it in there. I was starting to wonder what else were the options there were. So
I know it's, and it was just like so bizarre. And I think through that, I hadn't ever encountered anyone else who'd had that problem. But right after my first transfer, I posted about it on Instagram, and someone who was following me had the same experience, and also had to have general anaesthetic. I think, like, I see yeah, it's there's options, I guess, is the kind of moral of the story. But yeah, it wasn't, I did just feel like, oh my God, this is just so bizarre. That I can't, this poor fertility doctor cannot get this embryo in. Like, how am I gonna get pregnant? Like, it was just the weirdest experience. And I was just so upset driving home from that first failed transfer. But
Yeah, my brain is automatically going to, I wonder if you could have got pregnant naturally had you tried. Maybe.
I've had all kinds of jokes about that with my sister. But yeah, I don't know. It's just a weird thing. I think it's just the angle and the whatever. Yeah, I mean, but like, it's not a problem for a pap smear, but it's the passing of the catheter through and getting the angle right. Yeah, so it's just easier to knock me out, and I guess then they don't have to worry so much about whether it's uncomfortable for you and can just be a bit more aggressive with getting it in. Yeah.
So hopefully not too many more times that we had to be knocked out. What happened after that first cycle?
My third cycle, I did another egg retrieval. So I'd used my only kind of untested embryo in that second frozen transfer. Different protocol, had 10 eggs retrieved again, 9 mature, 4 fertilized. So I ended up with 4 embryos that time, and 3 of them were frozen. One wasn't suitable for testing. So that was just frozen. And then of the two that were suitable for testing, one was abnormal and one was mosaic. And I had a fresh transfer in that cycle, and it ended up being a chemical pregnancy, which really was just not a nice experience. And it's one of the reasons why, if I had my time again, I probably wouldn't transfer untested embryos. So yeah, few days there where I was trying to convince myself that my low HCG might have been late implantation, or maybe it was just low because, well, I don't know.
We can come
But
up with all sorts of reasons, can't we, to try and convince ourselves?
yeah, we sure can. So yeah, that cycle was a fail as well. So I did still have from that cycle, despite, the one abnormal and one mosaic, I had an untested frozen embryo. So my next cycle, it's my fourth cycle, I did a frozen transfer. So that was my third transfer.
Yep.
And that one was a negative as well. So then I did cycle, my fifth cycle was my third egg collection, and that was kind of middle of the year by that point. So it was July. We had to change my protocol again. I added in acupuncture. And that time I got 16 eggs.
Wow.
14 were mature. Yeah. And I got 5 blastocysts. We did a fresh transfer, and that one was negative. 2 went for testing, and 2 were frozen untested. And of the two that were tested, one was abnormal, and the other one would eventually become my baby. But unfortunately, while I was waiting for the testing to come back from that cycle, my mum was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. I kind of put the brakes on then, which was a hard decision to make because it suddenly felt incredibly urgent to get pregnant so that I would have a baby while she was here and well. And it just made me really have a very strong sense of her mortality. And, she's a huge part of my life, and she's an amazing grandparent. And, my niece and nephew are besotted with her. And I, it was a very scary time. I guess the main reason I put things on pause at that point was that I wanted to get her through the start of her treatment and her surgery. I didn't want, me to be throwing up with morning sickness and her to be throwing up from having chemo, and just wanted to make sure she was well and okay. I decided to take some time off and not transfer that embryo. Then I kind of wanted to get going again, and single woman finances are always a concern. And at that point, it was kind of late September, and I was well over the Medicare threshold. And I just kind of got to the point where I thought, I'd done 4 transfers by that point. I was like, I just didn't feel like having one euploid normal embryo in the freezer was enough of an insurance policy.
Okay.
And I also knew that with my mum unwell, I just wanted to kind of be done with the hard part of treatment. So I decided to do 2 more retrievals that year.
Oh, wow.
Um,
Okay.
So I left my kind of normal embryo frozen and did two back-to-back retrievals in October and November, which was kind of when I felt ready to start again. And so in October, I did a retrieval, got 9 eggs and 8 of them were mature. I got 4 embryos. They were all suitable for testing. And 2 of them ultimately came back normal. But the kind of big decision for me at that point was my mum was having genetic testing done to see if her ovarian cancer was had a genetic cause. So we biopsied my embryos, and then I had a couple of days to make a decision about whether they get tested on the PGT-A platform, which is where they do the aneuploidy testing to count the chromosomes, essentially, or whether we hold the testing back and have them tested on the PGTM platform once mum's genetic profile had been done, so we could tell if there was any genetic issues there. And that was a hard decision to make, because if you do test on the PGTM platform and you have any abnormalities there, you can't use the embryos. And I guess the question, I had a chat with a geneticist about it, and she kind of said to me, you need to think about is the fact that these embryos might carry an ovarian cancer gene, say they do, is that enough for you to not want to use them? Mm. She said, I think we're kind of at a stage where the treatment for things like breast cancer or having BRCA, you know, having a preventative double mastectomy and, you know, potentially hysterectomy. She said, I think we're close to thinking that might be a barbaric practice and having better ways of treating things in the future. And, you know, do you want to make that call now? You know, what's the later?
Yeah.
And, you know, we might have better treatments in the not too distant future. So I ummed and ahed and ultimately made the decision just to get them tested on the PGT-A platform to test for chromosomal abnormalities. And I think I'm comfortable with that decision. Those embryos, I'm not actually going to use anyway now. But yeah, it was kind of a tricky decision to make. And in the end, mum's genetic testing came back all normal. So it's a non-genetic. Yeah.
Which is good, because I'm sitting there going, thinking about you and your sister as well. So I'm really relieved.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we do have a family history. And so my grandmother had ovarian cancer as well. And so we've been advised that we should both have ovaries and fallopian tubes removed as well, just because there could be some other kind of underlying family inheritance issue. But it's not genetic, which is also good, because the same genes that cause ovarian cancer can cause problems with boys as well. So yeah, I think the other thing that's was different about that cycle is I actually had a different donor. So I had no vials left from my original donor, and I had to pick another donor for the last 2 cycles. So the embryos that I still have frozen are a different donor to the donor that I used for the earlier cycles with my little boy.
That's interesting. So with the one for your little boy, that would obviously be his family limit as well then, if you couldn't get any more access. But yeah, and so
yeah,
it's just changing to another donor. I've never really thought of that before, or that experience of having them in the freezer with 2 different.
Yeah, they don't usually do it, I don't think. I had to get special permission. And you know, the rationale was around my mum's diagnosis and that we didn't know what was going to happen and wanted to kind of make things move as quickly as possible in terms of getting embryos in the bank and getting pregnant and getting a baby here. So yeah, it's not the norm. And in hindsight, if I had intentions of having more than one child, and the research I've done now around donor conceived people's experiences, you know, I have like concerns about my own choice to use a different donor, because you know, there's donor conceived people seem to strongly indicate that having their siblings be full genetic siblings is the ideal. That's what they want. So
did you go into it intending to just have one though, or did you think you'd have more than one child?
I did intend to just have one. Yeah,
that kind of changes it as well. But yeah, if you did have siblings, having different donors could be a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, they have different experiences of meeting their donors, but also in terms of genetic mirroring, then their siblings don't have that kind of genetic mirroring happening in the sibling relationship. So, yeah. So yeah, I got two normal embryos from that six cycle, which was my fourth retrieval, and then I did one more a month later in kind of mid-November. Got seven eggs. It was my worst cycle. Things didn't go as well as normal. I had to stim for a very long time. I didn't respond the same. My retrieval was a lot later. I had a lot of stress
I was going to say,
going
there's
on.
probably a lot going on at home as well with your mum going through treatment by that stage.
Yeah, a lot going on at home, and it was also a very stressful time at work. But yeah, like mum was having chemo, and I was spending, my Thursday mornings every week at, working from the chemo place while she was having treatment. And yeah, so it wasn't the ideal time to be doing IVF, that's for sure. And I think acupuncture was like my one time in a couple of times in the week where it was just like a total stress reliever and just, a nice hour of blissed outness. So it was a good experience from that way. So yeah, that time around, I got seven eggs. Four were mature. I did end up getting a normal euploid embryo from that cycle as well. And so two were frozen. One of them ended up being mosaic, and yeah, one normal. And then instead of doing a fresh transfer, I transferred the embryo from my third retrieval that was frozen, my first normal embryo, which is my little boy. So yeah, I think I counted it all up. I had 52 eggs retrieved, made 16 embryos. Four of them ended up being normal, seven were untested, two mosaic, and three abnormal. And I think those numbers are the reason why, if I had my time again, I probably would just go straight to using tested embryos, is that they didn't stick. So the odds are that the four I transferred before were abnormal as well. My first normal embryo stuck, the first one I transferred. And sure, there's probably luck involved in that. But in hindsight, yeah, it feels like I feel like I don't know, it's my journey. It's not wasted time. But there's a lot of heartache through the process, right? That maybe could have been lessened if I'd tested, only transferred tested embryos, but also maybe not. So it's hard to know.
No point dwelling on that, is there? You've got your little man now, and that's all that matters.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the process has made me incredibly passionate about the fact that we do not tell women that it could be hard to have babies. We tell them to be careful not to get pregnant.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've been around infertility communities. My sister did IVF 15 years ago. I have lots of friends who've had babies and needed fertility treatment. I know stuff about infertility. I knew how IVF worked in and out before I did it. And I did not realize how drastically things become, egg quality diminishes after 35. And everyone talks about ovarian reserve, get your AMH tested. But the reality is, I had a fantastic AMH. I can't remember what it was, but it was like equivalent to someone in their 20s. But I didn't make normal embryos. And I think it's just really important that we educate women that you don't have forever. And
No.
I mean, I knew that, and I still dilly-dallied. But I just didn't understand, I guess, that I would potentially be, I don't know, I hadn't kind of twigged about this whole abnormal embryo situation. So yeah, I think my advice to anyone, like I see people posting on Facebook groups and forums about, oh, I'm freezing my eggs, and I just want to say, if you're committed to being a solo mum, just fertilize them. Now, like if you're 30 and you're thinking about this, get some sperm and get them fertilized and see what your egg quality is like, and are you going to make normal embryos? Because it's not, egg freezing is not a guarantee, and so many women think that it's going to be. I think you just have to, yeah, we just have to do better for women, I think, and girls. Like it's,
It's like
I
most
think.
people think, just assume, oh, IVF equals baby as well. It's like, no,
Yeah, it doesn't.
it doesn't.
No.
Yeah.
No. So yeah, I guess that's become something I'm really passionate about, is we just have to do better by women.
Yeah, everyone asks. We just get too scared that we're going to get pregnant just by holding hands, aren't we? Rather than at
Exactly. Yeah.
35, it's really, really challenging.
Yep. Yeah.
So you've got your little man now. How How is life as a solo mom? Is it what you thought it was going to be?
I guess I didn't necessarily let myself think about what life was going to be like as a solo mum. Pregnancy was weird for me. It all felt very theoretical. The whole process of being pregnant. I didn't let myself feel like it was going to result in a baby. I don't know. It was a very weird thing. I knew I was pregnant, and I had wild morning sickness for 4 months, like incredible. Just like I had to stop brushing my teeth in the morning because otherwise I couldn't keep a meal down. Like every time I put a toothbrush in my mouth, I threw up for 4 months. So I was like planning dinners based on what was going to be easiest to throw up when I brushed my teeth. And
Oh.
so I was reassured that I was pregnant because I was so sick. But I also just kind of didn't believe it. And like kind of the whole pregnancy, I think I spent too much time around infertility circles online, and I'd kind of seen my sister go through it and seen other people go through pregnancy complications. My sister had her twins at 30 weeks, and she went into labor at 20 weeks with them. So like I just always had this like all these kind of worries in my mind, and I kind of checked for blood my entire pregnancy, and then at 20 weeks I got diagnosed with complete placenta previa. So then I was really checking for blood. And so that whole experience was like, I guess I never kind of thought I was going to end up with a baby. So I can't tell you if life is like what I thought it was going to be like, because I didn't really
Didn't have
think about it. It's so bizarre. And then, I had him early. I had a bleed at 32 weeks. I had been hospitalized at 32 weeks and 2 days because my placenta previa hadn't resolved, and they wanted me in hospital in case I bled. I had a mild bleed. And then I had him at 35 weeks, 5 days, when I had another bleed. And so it was like initially life was weird because he was in special care, and that experience was strange.
Did he have to be there too long? Because he was almost cooked.
Yeah, he was only there for 9 days.
That's
He was pretty little. And I think the special care experience is something that I would really encourage solo mums to think about as well. I knew he was going to come early. We hoped we'd get him to 37 weeks, but it wasn't safe to be pregnant any longer than that. But after I had a bleed at 32 weeks, I was on bed rest for a few days, but I was in hospital and I'd had steroids and blah, blah, blah. And my OB and the pediatrician knew what I wanted to happen with him when he was born, and I ended up having to have a general anaesthetic and for my Caesar because it was kind of an emergency situation, and they can control bleeding better if you're anaesthetized than if you're awake. So I had an arterial line and general anaesthetic, and so I had been very clear about what I wanted to happen with my baby while I was unconscious. And if he could be held, I wanted, my mum was going to be, if I could have a Caesar without a general anaesthetic, my mum would be in there, and the baby would go out to my sister. If I did have to be anaesthetized, then they would be there. If he didn't need to be in a humidity crib or intubated or anything, then I wanted them to be able to do skin to skin. And I wanted them to be in the special care nursery waiting for him if that's what was needed. So those arrangements were all in place, and that all went really smoothly on the night. But post that, I'd been in hospital for a while. I'd done the tour of the special care nursery while I was in hospital. No one had asked me to do paperwork about letting my mum and my sister have access to my baby while I was not in special care. And so these are the things that I would say to solo mums, just for your own peace of mind post baby. You don't want to be day two or three with the blues and bawling your eyes out because some nurse in the special care nursery said to you, "You haven't done the paperwork for your sister to be in here, and she's been in here on her own with the baby." Like, she is his other, like, parent, caregiver for all intents and purposes. So yeah, I think I would definitely encourage solo mums to have conversations with their OBs and the hospital about what might happen in those situations, because that was a lot of unnecessary angst I didn't need in that period. So yeah, he had a fairly quick stay in special care, and you know, it was fine because I'd been in hospital for 4 weeks by that point. So it was like my second home, and I,
You
you
knew
know,
everybody.
knew everybody. Everybody knew me. And yeah, so that, you know, it's not a nice experience having to leave your baby in special care, but unfortunately, I like just a kind of confluence of or a bunch of different factors meant that I couldn't breastfeed. I just never got any milk. He was early. It was an
Caesar.
emergency, yeah, Caesar emergency. All the things, you know, I'd pump for 20 minutes and get 9 mils of milk. And I just wanted him out of special care, and I was tiring him by trying to breastfeed him and then bottle feed him a top up and then pump. So I just went full formula. Actually, my sister went out and bought me the Formula Pro formula maker machine. She's like, I think you should stop pumping. You have this.
And this is amazing, though, if anyone is doing formula.
Oh, my
It's like
gosh.
a coffee machine for making formula. Life-changing, especially in the middle of the night. I love mine. It's brilliant.
Oh, it is the bomb. Like, we had an 8-9 day power outage after Christmas here. We had a tornado go through, and I didn't have the formula machine. And my child is very keen. Like, he likes his formula at the precise right temperature. So I'm out the back in a heat wave. And like pouring rain, like heating water on a camping stove so his bottle could be the right temperature. And the first thing, once we got a generator off a friend, the very first thing I plugged in was the baby brezza. I was like, this is getting plugged in. So yeah, that did help make that decision. But yeah, so I couldn't breastfeed, and it turns out actually that was probably not a bad thing because he's got cow's milk protein intolerance, and it meant I could sort that out pretty quickly because it just meant a formula change instead of having a time delay with me cutting dairy out of my diet.
And you get to keep eating cheese. So
I get to keep eating cheese. Yeah. My poor child is deprived though. But yes, so.
Hopefully he'll get to grow out of it though. That's pretty common.
I think so. We're expecting him to. Yeah. 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 But he is just like, touch wood, the most chill, delightful baby. He is like, I've just been so fortunate. He's like, even with cow's milk protein intolerance and reflux, and he's also got laryngomalacia. So he has like a floppy, extra floppy cartilage around his voice box. So we nicknamed him the squeaker early on because he was like kind of squeaking all the time. And then it turns out that's actually a product of the fact he's got like floppy cartilage in his throat. It's not really dangerous, but they can, like, it can cause aspiration. He should grow out of it as well. But like kind of those things going on, and he's still just an absolutely delightful, content baby. He had a period between like 4 and 6 months where he was very frustrated because he wanted to sit up all the time and couldn't. And that, I think, that was like one of the more challenging periods for me. But yeah, he's like just a really easygoing baby. And I think, you know, often I think there's maybe formula fed babies sleep through the night sooner than breastfed babies. So, you know, he sleeps well. I'm also like, I guess, I always knew that I'd eventually end up co-sleeping when he was older because it just like when,
it feels
with
like
toddlers.
Yeah. Whether
yeah.
we like it or not.
Yeah. But I did it a lot earlier than I expected. It took me a while to get comfortable, but by 4 months, we were co-sleeping for naps because I'd been contact. Well, what he was napping really well because the beauty of special care is they come out, like you feed them, you wrap them up, put them down, and they go to sleep. They are in an amazing routine. They're used to going to sleep unattended because you're not meant to, well, I mean, there's lots of schools of thought, but the kind of school of thought that you often get in special care nurseries is you don't want to move them around because you don't want them to burn energy because you want them to be gaining weight. So, so they just take themselves off to sleep and sleep well. And so he came home like sleeping beautifully and napping and putting himself to sleep independently. And then his reflux got really bad around 7 weeks. And so I just felt like I couldn't put him down until I'd held him up for an hour post feed to make sure he wasn't going to spew it all up and be uncomfortable. And I'd lie him down in the co-sleeper beside me, and I could hear it go up and down. I could, like, even if it didn't come out, I could hear the kind of reflux coming up his throat and going down again. So I broke his amazing sleeping by holding him off. And so by the time we got to 4 months, I was kind of done with contact napping and wanted an alternative. And so I started co-sleeping for naps. And then, yeah, now we're just like all about the co-sleeping life. He's nearly 9 months old, and yeah, we fully co-sleep all the time. But yeah.
We co-sleep, I get no say in it. I said, are you sleeping in your bed or mummy's bed? And she's like, mummy's bed. I'm not sleeping there till I'm much older. So, okay, good.
Oh, bless.
Wonderful. Thanks.
Whatever works, you know,
I
we
want to
both
be near
get so
you. And
much
it's
more
like, well, kind
sleep.
of sweet, but okay.
It is sweet. It is really sweet. And I don't know about you, but we just get so much more sleep. Like I'm not getting up to stick the dummy back in. I can just kind of reach over and poke it in. He knows I'm right there, and yeah, it just works.
It does. Definitely not the end of the world. I've got a snoring dog and a cat as well, so you know.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The dogs had to move out of my bed, but I mean, he'd made that transition while I was in hospital. So it's not like we call like when we talk about the baby to the dog, we call the baby the interloper. So it's not like the interloper has stolen his spot in the bed that he knows of anyway.
And how do you think it's changed you as a woman becoming a mum finally?
That's a really interesting question. I think the first kind of 4 months of his life, I was probably the most present and grounded and centered that I've ever been in my life. And I was just in a lovely bubble and just so content in having everything I'd ever wanted. I did like it was a bit rocky at the beginning. I think one of the things about being older, having a baby, is you know yourself very well. And at like, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks postpartum, my anxiety was like through the roof. And I knew myself well enough at that point to go, right, I need to go see my psychologist. And at that point, I'd been off my ADHD medication for a long time because I'd been trying to conceive and then pregnant.
You can't
And so I
take it while
needed,
you're trying to conceive.
I could have, but I decided not to. I just wanted to be, I wanted to be, to make things, to make sure it was okay, I guess. And I probably could have taken something while I was pregnant, but I didn't want to mess with it. You know, there's not enough evidence, and so I just didn't go there. So I went and saw on the same day both my psychologist and my psychiatrist. And actually, when I came home from the hospital, the second day he was home from the hospital, I was bringing stuff downstairs, and I fell down the stairs, and I had this like incredible like I was so anxious. I was like my immediate reaction was, oh my God, what if I was holding the baby? And so that I think started my anxiety spiral. And I'm really confident with him. I'm really confident with the babies in general. I've had a lot of experience with babies. But I just had this kind of underlying panic all the time. And so I, you know, 3 weeks or so in, I took myself off to the psychologist and the psychiatrist. And my psychologist is like, it's actually completely rational for you to be worried about falling down the stairs with a baby because you just fell down the stairs. So I don't think you've got a problem. This is rational anxiety. So yeah, so that kind of thing was tricky. But yeah, in general, those first 4 months, I felt just so calm and centered and like my best self. And I feel like this was just always what I, and still even now, like this is always what I was meant to do, and how things were meant to be. And I think things got a bit more challenging, like between 4 and 6 months when he was a bit kind of frustrated with life because he wanted to do things that he couldn't do. And,
And maybe
you know,
quite determined like someone else we know.
just a little bit determined. And we had a, you know, a bumpy period. We all had COVID over Christmas, and then we had power outage for 9 days, and we had to go kind of place hop to have some kind of to have electricity, and life was a bit difficult. And that really threw me for six, I think, at that time. But I also think probably around the 6 month mark, I got to a point where I probably needed to be doing something different with my brain. And not just being in a baby bubble. And I always wondered how I was going to go being home with a baby for 12 months because I've never had an extended time away from work. I've always worked and worked hard and been, you know, really invested in work. So in hindsight, probably it would have been good to have planned to be doing something around about that 6 month mark. It couldn't have been a lot, but I don't know. I just needed to do something. I needed some kind of side project or something.
I think I started doing a lot of sewing around that point, so yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, and I kind of yeah, I wish I'd kind of thought about that more. And I always planned to pick up some consultancy work in the second half of my maternity leave, but possibly I could have started that a bit earlier. That might have been wise. But yeah, I just feel like this is who I was meant to be, and this little being was meant to be in my life, and we were meant to kind of have him in this commune. And, you know, I've got so much support. I've had a very different experience to, I think, a lot of other solo mums. I have, you know, we have shared mental load around everything. I don't have the mental load of running a house solo. I've got my mum who's in remission, living with me, my sister next door. We cook meals as a family, you know, we meal plan together. I didn't have to worry about what I was going to eat for the first, you know, however long, until I felt ready to kind of start contributing to that again. And, you know, my mum has wanted to, like, she's washed all the bottles and done all the washing because she wants me to enjoy having a baby and to spend the time with him. And, you know, we have to argue, and I have to argue about things like, I want to fold his washing. I enjoy that feeling of accomplishment of, like, actually getting something done. So I just have, like, incredible support that's just allowed me to really lean into being super present. And yeah, that's been great. Because the other thing I will say is that there is no hiding for me that I have ADHD having a child. Like, if I didn't know before I had a baby, then I would definitely realize now that something is wrong with my executive function. Yeah, it's been a bit wild. And I think kind of the starting solids really was a big deal for me, like, in terms of, like, working out how to plan his meals and all of that stuff. And maybe if I was feeding him stuff out of a packet, sometimes that would help, but he's got at least food intolerances. And so I'm kind of juggling, I cook everything from scratch, and kind of wanting to be attentive, and we read lots of books, and I want to spend the time sitting on the floor with him, but, you know, I have to go cook food and that, all that kind of juggle, which is, it's the life stuff. And I guess there's just an extra layer of it now, and, like, you know, getting him off to daycare and those kinds of things. I just have to have systems in place, and now I've got all my systems and I feel confident and capable in all of that. But yeah, I think that really kind of probably about 6 months, I was like, yeah, I'm definitely very ADHD, and it is definitely like impacting on my experience of parenting. And the days that I remember to take my Ritalin 3 times, it's great. And the days I don't, slightly wilder. Yeah.
I know you will have done a lot of research before you even got pregnant about the implications for donor conceived people and meeting the donors. So have you thought anything about when you'll make contact with donor or donor siblings?
Yeah, this is a really tricky thing for me. The one thing I didn't do enough research about was donor conceived people's experiences. And it's really hard. I don't want to say I've got regrets. It's hard to say you've got regrets about anything to do with your perfect child who you adore and is the kind of center of your world. But I do regret not doing that research, because I used an ID release donor from the US. And in hindsight, I don't think that was the best decision for my child in terms of their capacity to get in touch with the donor in the future or donor siblings. And I guess when I was choosing what I was going to do in terms of donor, I probably could have had some options around known donors. And I made a decision not to go down that path because I thought it might be confusing for my future child to have someone who they knew who was genetically related to them, but not kind of a part of their, what I now know is a social family versus a kind of genetic family. So I kind of deliberately made the decision not to, to go down that path. But in hindsight, I understand that that was potentially not the best decision for him. Mm-hmm. And I want to go about making those connections as soon as I can. And I've made it difficult, and I'm really conflicted because I suspect, you know, probably what I need to do to help him make those connections is to do genetic testing through something like Ancestry or 23andMe. But I'm very, very conflicted about that, about the ethics of DNA testing my child and submitting his DNA to a massive database owned by a corporation that's potentially, you know, got religious roots as well. And what are they going to do with his data? And I think that my kind of background in technology research makes me hesitate about that. And that's where I am right now. I've done kind of most of the things that I can do without submitting his DNA to one of those places. I've kind of posted on the Seattle Sperm Bank site with my donor code. And I keep searching all the time to see if I can find the donor code pop up anywhere. But that's something I need to grapple with. And I've had some kind of, I recently got into a fairly heated conversation on a donor conceived Facebook group about this, because a lot of donor conceived people say, just do it. And lots of recipient parents say, just do it as well. But I feel like, you know, there's some quite strong language in some of those groups around human rights and the right to know your parentage, which can be very confronting as a recipient parent, especially as someone who really didn't want a parent with another person who deliberately wanted to use a donor. There's some very confronting language and rhetoric in there, but we have to listen to it because these are donor conceived people's experiences. Or I think we have to listen to it anyway. So, you know, there's lots of talk about, I guess there's lots of talk about kids having a human right to know their parentage and to know their genetic family. But for me, I feel like I made it, for me, potentially the wrong call in using an ID released donor in terms of my child's future. If I had my time again, I might have made a different decision. I didn't, and that is what it is. But now that I know better, I want to do better. And I feel like, do I have the right? Would I be contravening his rights by submitting his DNA to one of these services? My instinct is yes, because I don't want my DNA in there. And I know lots of other people don't want their DNA in these places as well. But there's lots of people in donor conceived advocacy groups and communities that say, you've already made this one decision without consulting your child to use an ID release donor. Why do you now think you can't make this decision? And for me, that's really tricky ground. I just don't know what I'm going to do there, to be honest.
Lots of people who've used the Seattle Sperm Bank have managed to make connection with donor or with donor siblings. So hopefully you'll get that and then won't need to make that other decision as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't feel super urgent because, you know, he's not even one yet. But I do think that my perspective on this is that I need to make it a viable option for him to connect with his siblings in order for him to make an informed choice about if that's what he wants. And so to make it a viable option, I've got to find them and I've got to form those connections so I've got them when he decides what he wants to do. So yes, I will do everything I can short of DNA testing for now. If there's anyone who's done any research about donor conceived people's perspectives on DNA testing more generally, because I'm concerned that I'm listening to one kind of group of people, but what is everyone's perspectives on this? If anyone knows who's done the research or can do the research, that'd be great.
Yeah, certainly a lot to grapple with there, but hopefully you'll make a connection soon, and then at least that opens the door to what the future could be.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I don't regret my choice. You can't regret it when you've got this amazing outcome from it. But I do wish that I'd made things easier for him. And I didn't have, there were no local donors for me to choose from.
Not at all.
No, at my clinic, I only had overseas donors at that point. Maybe I could have waited, but also I was nearly 40 and I don't know how long I could have waited for. And, you know, my experience with not making normal embryos suggests that maybe I couldn't have waited much longer, really. And I'm just going to do my absolute best to help him make those connections and to give him the best life I can give him and to make sure I listen to other donor conceived people's experiences on how to make this life the best life for him.
And it's one of those hard things because there's always some people that have very strong opinions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that will be your son's opinion either. He might be completely fine and not have any interest whatsoever. But like you
That's
say,
right.
All you can do is create the avenue so if he does have interest and wants to know that we can make it easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So anyone who is just considering whether this is the right path for them, what advice would you give them?
It probably sounds trite to say just do it and do it sooner than you otherwise might, because I know that these are the answers that people always give to this question. But I think based on my experience, do it as early as you can is the advice that I have to give, because like it wasn't an easy road. It wasn't particularly hard. I didn't have to, in the end, I was able to make a normal embryo and I got pregnant with my first cycle. But I did have that reality check of, is my mum actually going to be here? Is she going to get through this cancer and be here when I have a baby? And that's a decision, and even if she didn't have cancer, she's a lot older than she might have been if I had a baby earlier, and I want her to be around and to have a relationship with a grandchild, and I want to be here to be with him as long as possible too. And I've shortened that time by waiting, I wish I hadn't done that. I guess I wasn't ready earlier because I kept putting it off, but I wish I had have invested in getting ready earlier, and getting myself to a point, because I knew this is how I wanted to have a baby. I always knew. It wasn't that I was waiting for a partner. I was just waiting. I wasn't waiting either. I was kind of like always talking about doing it, always going to do it, but just never quite pulled the trigger. Yeah. Procrastinating, actually, that's kind of the theme of my life. I shouldn't have procrastinated about it for so long. And in my typical fashion, like done all the research and like th thought through all the options, and apart from thinking too much about donor conceived people's experiences, obviously. But yeah, I wish I'd done it earlier, and I would say to people, absolutely get started as soon as you can, because fertility does decline, and your AMH might be okay. Don't rely on having a good AMH. Like, it's yes, get it tested. That's the first step in knowing, where you're sitting. But don't be like me and get your AMH tested in your mid-30s and go, oh, I've got heaps of time. My AMH is fine, and then find out that actually it's not just about quantity. It's about the quality of your eggs. And so start as soon as you can, for sure. But the other piece of advice I would give is to really think about things from the perspective of your child. I thought I was thinking about my future child when I was kind of going through this process, but really it was all centered around my desire to be a mother. And that's the biggest thing that shifted for me when I had him, is that it's all about him now, and his experience of the world, and his experience of the way I've chosen to have him. And I would just say, when you're making key decisions along this path, think about how that's going to play out for your child in the future. And don't necessarily let it change your path or curb your decisions or stop you from pursuing this path, because it is the most wonderful thing. But I think really think about that child as a donor conceived person in the future, and how can you make the best possible decisions to give them the best possible start in life, and to position them so that if they want to pursue knowing who their genetic relatives are in the future, that they can do that. Because I think for me, once he was in front of me, yeah, things just changed, and it is just all about him. And I thought it was before, but I did make decisions that probably were more me focused than him focused, and that definitely has shifted.
And what are you most looking forward to with him in the future?
I look forward to, it's the everyday things, and one of like I we read so many books together, and I love like introducing him to books and literature and the things that I love. And I just look forward to the everyday experiences and kind of and of doing these things with him, and seeing him. I guess one of the most amazing things through this whole process has been seeing the people that I love fall in love with him. And so I look forward to kind of introducing him to more of my people and my world, and seeing him experience things and see how people react to him and engage with him. Yeah, it's just, he's a delight, and I just delight in watching him delight in the world.
Well, that seems like a very beautiful place to end. So thank you so much, Kate, for sharing your story today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alicia, and this is the No Need for Prince Charming podcast, bringing you stories of Australian solo mums who created their own happy ending. If you like what you heard, please follow or subscribe to make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, and leave a like, a review, or share with your friends to help others find it easier. Bye for now.